This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. We usually look back at the previous week in WMRA news on the show, but now that we're beginning a new year, it's a good time to compile the top stories from 2015. But what's the criteria for top stories? Well, I thought a good measure would be those stories that got the most clicks on our website. That reflects the amount of attention each story got through social media and the effort that listeners made to find and hear these stories. And so, in some sense, a measure of perhaps the best stories of 2015, at least those that you, our listeners, found most compelling. So, without further ado, the top four, that's all I've got time for today, stories of 2015 from the WMRA newsroom, beginning with this one from July. Shortly after the town of Buena Vista acquired an expensive new drug-sniffing dog, and WMRA's Jesse Nadler brought us the story.
Sergeant Mitchell Harrison has been a cop in Buena Vista for 15 years, and he really loves dogs.
We thought that would help the community and the surrounding areas. It's something that I've wanted for a long time. I've had a desire to be a canine officer for some time, and the opportunity fronted itself, and I took it.
The opportunity he refers to is grant money from the Virginia Attorney General's office that became available as a result of a multi-million dollar Medicaid fraud settlement in 2012. Local police departments were invited to apply for some of the money to fund such things as new bulletproof vests, cop cars, and in the case of the BVPD, a new drug dog. The department received a check from the state for $46,000 in April. Why so much? Well, a four-legged drug sniffer isn't cheap. The dog itself cost $10,000.
It's $9,945 to be exact. The canine's coming from Tar Heel Canine out of Sanford, North Carolina. This dog's going to have several different capabilities. He'll be able to do some search and rescue stuff as well as, you know, narcotics and things. You know, the $10,000 is a lot of money for a dog, but that includes the dog, the trainer's school, the handler school.
That's another $10,000.
Housing while I'm there, and then an equipment package. You know, you have to have different harnesses, leashes.
Vet bills, food, chew toys, it adds up. The backseat of Sergeant Harrison's squad car had to be torn out and turned into some sort of caged robo-canine insert. Sergeant Harrison took me and another reporter out for a demo of the dog's skills.
What I'll do is I'm going to give him a command to search for human odor.
Body, that's his name, is an imposing-looking animal, but he's friendly, too. He's a 3-year-old German Shepherd who weighs 90 pounds. He was born in Slovakia and only responds to check commands.
What I'll do first is just let him kind of free search.
He's trained on 4 scents: methamphetamines, heroin, cocaine, and marijuana. He can detect a lot of other odors too, bullet shell casings, anything a human has touched. When he finds something, in this case a tube of chapstick I had tossed into a field, he lays down suddenly, passive and quiet. This was intentional. Some drug dogs are trained to react aggressively, scratching and pawing, but Sergeant Harrison wanted a more subdued approach because it's much less scary for the unsuspecting public.
Bodie just sat down.
People think, oh, they feed them drugs and they do all this stuff. They don't. They teach them the odor.
Right.
And when he smells whatever odor he's trained in, there's a bunch of odors out there. Same thing with an explosive dog. He thinks, hey, there's my Kong ball. There's my toy. That's what I want. He doesn't know that what he's smelling is marijuana or cocaine or methamphetamine.
The idea is that Body will be one more tool local and state police can use as part of a joint effort to fight the spread of drugs. Rockbridge County Sheriff's Department already has 2 canines. Methamphetamine use, in particular, is a growing concern in the county, with more mini-meth labs showing up in vehicles. Body comes at an interesting time for the Buena Vista Police Department. The town is undergoing serious financial strain as a result of a defaulted loan on an unsuccessful golf course for which the city offered up key properties, including the police department, as collateral. The department has been in a state of flux for some time. Officers have left. Morale hasn't exactly been sky high. It's uncertain whether the 16-man force will even stay in the same building if the lender decides to foreclose on the property. The city very recently hired new police chief Keith Hartman, a 23-year veteran of Newport News Police, who commanded a force of 80, to come in and turn things around.
Oh, I'm very impressed with the professionalism of the officers. We are short a few bodies that we're trying to replace as quickly as we can. And I think when we get the staffing up, we'll be in pretty good shape.
Regarding Sergeant Harrison's canine initiative, Chief Hartman is totally on board.
A canine unit is a really good tool for a police agency to have, and for other police agencies in the area, too, to share that asset. No, I'm just excited to be here. I'm looking forward to this challenge, and hopefully we're successful.
For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
Our third most popular story of the year is from October, when Carol Lofton talked to three teachers who are bringing the practice of restorative justice into their classrooms.
You know that I'm not.
That's what you mean.
You know what I mean, Dana. You know it will not end well for you. Now get out of my room!
That was one of almost 20,000 similar videos on YouTube of teachers or students yelling at one another. We don't know what happens after the video ends or what happened before it started that caused the teacher to lose his cool. But most commenters assume the kid eventually left the class and served some kind of well-deserved punishment. But what if it was possible to prevent such a scenario in the first place? Sisters Allison and Carolyn Eanes both teach 6th grade English, Allison in Harrisonburg and Carolyn in Harlem, New York. Both use restorative justice practices in their classrooms, which is the idea that conflict often occurs because of broken relationships, not because students are actively trying to be bad. It is an alternative to the zero-tolerance policies in place in many schools around the country, which educators like Rob Fenimore, another Harrisonburg-based teacher, say are not working.
When I think about restorative justice, I think about meeting needs and paying attention to the harm that's caused all the parties involved. Let's take the example of a child misbehaving in class, whether towards another classmate or towards the teacher.
One way to solve that would be to remove or punish the student who is being disruptive. But Fenimore says if he can remove himself from the equation, he said classroom disruption often feels very personal, and ask, why is the child acting that way? He can humanize the child as a complex being with struggles that may have nothing to do with the scenario at hand.
And then give the child who's acting up a chance to say why he or she is acting that way. I feel like in that moment, some real magic can happen where the offending child can hear what he or she is doing wrong to others, the impact that's having. And for the person who's being distracted, or in my case as a teacher, I can tell that child, what you're doing hurts me. That's a phrase that I've used a lot with kids. Rather than get out or you're really making me angry, I will often start with a kid, what you're doing hurts me, and then give the example of why it's hurting me.
But in order for that kind of restorative justice to work in classrooms, there needs to be a foundation of trust between students and teachers. In Allison Eanes' 6th grade classroom in Harrisonburg, students are setting up chairs for a circle process. Eanes gets out her talking piece, which for her is a little metal sun. Whoever is holding the talking piece is the only one in the circle allowed to speak.
We're going to respect the talking piece. We're going to speak and listen with respect. We're going to speak and listen from the heart. We're going to really try and be present today. And we're going to honor privacy.
Eanes does circles about once a week. They are a way for her to build trust with her students by facilitating an atmosphere of open, honest, and safe communication. And the students really like it.
It lets us learn how to trust people, like even maybe they're just acquaintances or just best friends. You still get to trust them and see if they can be trusted and like if you can tell them anything.
That was Jafar Mansour, one of Allison Eanes' students. His classmate, Niga Salan, chimed in. She said for her, the circle provides a safe space to speak openly and honestly without fear that classmates will gossip about her opinions. Jordan Perez, a third student, agreed.
One of our rules is to honor privacy in the circle, and so people know that we can trust them about, like, when they share stuff that they don't want other people to know, that they know that they can trust us.
Carolyn Eanes came to teaching through social work. She said she saw that young people were continually being, quote, shut down, dehumanized, marginalized, and disempowered.
It's abundantly clear to me that those ways of working with young people and treating young people are not working, and they certainly aren't preparing them to be anything but future inmates in our criminal justice system. I mean, the school to prison pipeline is so clear to me that how that functions. And so not only are many of our practices of like militantly locking down schools and keeping kids in line and forcing them to take a million tests, those are obviously not working.
None of the three teachers claim that restorative justice will always work or that it is the only and best answer to conflict. But it is an alternative they find highly effective. Because when it does work, advocates say, trust is built, students stay in class, and teachers are better able to do what they want to do, teach. For WMRA News, I'm Carol Lofton.
We have to go all the way back to April for our number two story of the year. Until recently in Virginia, when a same-sex couple gave birth to a child that was biologically one of the partners, the other partner had no legal claim to that child, even if the couple had been legally married elsewhere. But Supreme Court rulings in favor of same-sex marriage and changes to Virginia's law about birth certificates means that's no longer the case. And Carol Lofton got the story of two Rockingham County women and how these changes are affecting their family.
Tell me, what are you? What's that animal?
Cow.
A cow. What does a cow say?
Moo.
And that's a dog.
That's Kelsey Marker reading to her son, Beckett. Kelsey and Megan Marker married in Washington, D.C. in the spring of 2012. At the time, same-sex marriage was not legal in Virginia. Kelsey explains her decision.
It was important for us to have legal ceremonies so that we could have the paperwork and the documentation stating that we were legally married. We knew that this meant that we wouldn't have any marriage rights in Virginia, but we were okay with that. At the time, we were hopeful that things would change, and we were able to see other states in the nation slowly changing.
Soon after their marriage, the couple began to think about starting a family. Kelsey became pregnant with the help of an anonymous donor, and their son, Beckett, was born in April of 2013.
We got pregnant through a donor, and we learned that in Virginia, only the biological parent would be able to be listed on the birth certificate, and only a man and a woman could be listed on the birth certificate. So I carried Beckett. He is biologically mine. Megan was, of course, part of the pregnancy from day one, day zero even. And we were disappointed to learn that he legally would only be mine because in Virginia we were not legally married, and a non-legally married couple that is not a man and a woman cannot be joint parents on a birth certificate.
But then, in October of last year, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of same-sex marriage in five states, including Virginia. In a statement issued that day, Attorney General Mark Herring said that now, quote, same-sex couples in the Commonwealth are entitled to all the rights and privileges of marriage. For Kelsey and Megan, that meant Megan could now legally adopt Beckett. They began to search Harrisonburg and surrounding areas for a family attorney who would take their case and help them go to court to navigate a step-parent adoption, as Megan explains.
Unfortunately, we had a really hard time finding attorneys. Nobody in Harrisonburg had done this. Nobody knew how to do it. And nobody was willing to look into it even, except for Clint Sellers, who is not a family attorney.
But Sellers does happen to be Kelsey Marker's boss. In addition to that personal interest, he found the case attractive from a historical perspective and was interested to see how this new law would affect the work he does on a regular basis, estate planning. Here's Megan again.
He did a lot of research for us and was really great discovering that we did need to go forward with a step-parent adoption. And so we went to court in early March of 2015 and found out that we were actually wrong.
Well, not wrong exactly, but their options had changed. They learned that 2 days before they filed for Megan to adopt Beckett, the Division of Vital Records in Virginia determined that they could reissue birth certificates to families like the Markers who fit a specific set of requirements. The couple must be legally married in a state that recognized same-sex marriage prior to the birth of the child. The child must be biologically related to one of the parents, and the donor must not be able to make any legal claims on the child. In the Markers' case, because they use what is called a double-blind donor, they know nothing about the donor, and he knows nothing about them, they happen to fit those specifications.
The birth certificate would make the other proceedings superfluous, and it's not necessary to go through the step-parent adoption if, as a matter of state law and policy, she can simply be noted as his mother on his birth certificate. And from that then flows all of the benefits that other children enjoy, including the rights to inherit and other property-related rights that affect estates and planning for families.
So now the markers are waiting. The revised birth certificate is late coming, but Sellers said that's not unusual for state documents and that he believes the change will come through in due time. Megan explains the hurdles that remain, regardless of the Supreme Court's upcoming ruling on same-sex marriage.
Everybody has a different story. I mean, for us, it's about our son, and it's about safety and protection there. But for some people, it's not about children. For some people, it's about supporting their spouse during a medical emergency or crisis. For some, it's about just having that recognition that they had a spouse after death. It's just that everyone has a different story, and they all deserve rights and protection that everyone else in this country is given.
For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Well, now it's time for our top story of 2015. It was really no contest. This story from August got well over 100,000 hits on our website. It truly went viral and sparked a spirited discussion in the online comments. It was a story about the way that we deal with death, particularly a new way in which many trauma workers and other hospital staff now handle the death of a patient in the moments afterward. This story out of Charlottesville by Kara Lofton also aired on NPR in September, but here's the original WMRA story, our number one story from 2015.
These sounds from an actual training clip from Medic Video on YouTube are reenacted every day in emergency rooms all around the country, including at the University of Virginia Medical Center. A stretcher, fresh off an ambulance, comes sweeping through the emergency room doors. EMTs, nurses, doctors, and techs run toward the patient, equipment, a room, scrambling, hoping to save the life. It is the irony of this moment, when the patient's life is slipping away, that they, the medical workers, feel so alive. Adrenaline makes them hyper-alert, and their own hearts pump faster, as if willing the heart and the body on the stretcher to keep pumping too. But they are too late. The patient dies, and there's someone else who needs saving. So they put down their tools, clean up, and move on. For the past 8 or 9 years, variations on this scenario have been trauma nurse Jonathan Bartel's reality.
Each time we would attempt to resuscitate them, you know, at times we couldn't save them. And it started to wear on me at times, and I started to notice staff responses to that. And staff responses were often frustration, disappointment, a feeling of failure. You could see pain in the physician's eyes. You see pain in the nursing staff.
In order to cope, he said, most medical professionals stop thinking of the person in the bed as a person, but rather just a body that they are trying to resuscitate. Disconnection, he acknowledges, is necessary on some level, but it can also be harmful and lead to burnout, a state he said he has experienced on more than one occasion. One day, about 2 years ago, after Bartel's team tried and failed to resuscitate a patient, a chaplain came into the room.
We had worked on this patient for hours, and the chaplain came in and kind of stopped everyone from leaving the room. And I'm like, wow, that's really bold. And she said, I'm just going to pray over this patient, and then you all can leave. And I watched it, and I felt it was the act of stopping people. It inspired me.
The prayer portion was hard for him because he said he, like many others at the hospital, comes from a different religious tradition than the chaplain. But he kept thinking about her action.
So the next time we worked on another person who didn't make it, this time I decided to be bold and stop people from leaving. And it just came to me. I just said, could we stop and just for a moment, let's just take a moment to stop and recognize this person in the bed. You know, this person before they came in here were alive. They were interacting with family. They were loved by others. They had a life. And if we could just take a moment as a group of people and just stop and just recognize this person in our own way and in silence, just take a pause and take a break and just do this together, but in silence.
The team agreed.
When it was done, and I only did it for about a minute, and then I said thank you all, and thank you all for all the efforts that we did to try to save them. People walked out of the room and they thanked me and they thought it was really awesome. And then other nurses started to replicate this and do it. So I realized I had something that should probably continue. Just by the fact that because other people wanted to do it themselves and felt empowered to do it themselves, it started to carry on and started to actually take a life of its own.
Practitioners at UVA, ranging from EMTs to nurses to anesthesiologists, are now adopting the pause. In 2013, Dori Fontaine, dean of UVA School of Nursing, talked about the pause during a keynote address at a trauma nursing conference. A nurse there, Michael Day, who was a trauma care coordinator at a hospital in Washington State, took the concept back to Providence Sacred Heart Medical Center in Spokane, where it is now being used. The concept is spreading, Bartel said, because it works. The pause has made a big difference for many at UVA, such as EMT and hospital tech Jack Berner, who says it gives him closure.
Death is a word that you have to use in this setting. You can't use other terms to kind of soften it. But again, it makes it so we can actually view the person as a person rather than as a patient that we see on an everyday basis. You can relate more to the case, saying, you know, it's somebody's father or their mother or their sister or uncle, or rather than just somebody you see for 5 minutes, it makes it more real.
Prior to the pause, Bartel said hospital workers process death and dying two main ways. They either became emotionally numb or they were unable to disconnect the patient's death from their own life experience. Both ways are unhealthy and lead to burnout. What is better, from Bartel's perspective, is to cultivate what he calls a permeable membrane, which the pause helps develop.
And this membrane allows some in, but it also allows some out. So you're able to feel and you're also able to sense and give back. So I think the best way to cope with that in a healthy way is you acknowledge your feelings when someone dies. You acknowledge the pain of that. But we don't own that. That's not my death. That's not my family. But I can acknowledge that this is a natural process and this is what happens. And I can also acknowledge the pain that I bore witness to in caring for that family and for that patient.
For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
In 2015, WMRA produced more than 150 stories from right here in your community. And we couldn't do it without you. And who knows what we'll discover in 2016. Find out how you can support the News and Information Fund at WMRA.org, where you'll also find all of our stories from the newsroom. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'm grateful for your support, and I'm looking forward to bringing you lots more news in 2016. And I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday, and Happy New Year.